Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Behind the Knife and another HPD episode. Today, we're extremely excited to discuss a recent article published in JAMA Surgery in July 2021 titled Progression versus Stability of Branch Duct Intraductal Papillary Mucinous Neoplasms After Observation and Surgery. We're thrilled to bring you the first author of the paper, Dr. Giovanni Marchegiani of the Pancreas Institute in Verona, Italy, for an interview later in the episode.
Our most recent Clinical Challenges in Surgery episode was about IPMNs, so if you haven't listened to that episode first, we'd highly recommend that you do that first as a review. Otherwise, let's dive into an overview of the article before our interview. Beth, do you want to take us through the overall objectives and the methods of the study?
Yeah, absolutely, Lexi. So the overall goal of the study is to balance two fundamental challenges of studying IPMNs. The first would be without considering the overall denominator of IPMNs and considering only those who undergo resection, we're likely overestimating the risk of progression to malignant disease. The second is that by expanding the study pool to those who do not have a pathologically confirmed IPMN, we likely underestimate the risk of malignant neoplasms. So this study is a multi-center retrospective study of centers in Italy, Korea, Singapore, and the US that specifically assessed what dynamic variables are associated with malignant progression in pathologically proven IPMNs under at least a year of initial surveillance. So all patients undergoing surgery for a branch duct IPMN from January 1st, 2000 to December 31st, 2019, with an initial 12-month surveillance period were considered for inclusion. Indications for surgery were based in the initial part of the study on no guidelines. However, from 2006, the Sendai criteria were generally applied, and from 2012 to their revision in 2017, the Fukuoka guidelines were used.
Just a reminder for the listeners, the Fukuoka guidelines carry a few basic principles. First, you have to think about worrisome features versus high-risk stigmata. The high-risk stigmata mainly include the masses that you're concerned contain cancer. So those are ones with main ducts greater than 10 millimeters without another explaining factor like a main duct stone, cyst with an enhancing mural nodule that's greater than 5 millimeters, or something that's hard causing obstructive jaundice. Worrisome features include some more borderline criteria like a thicker enhancing wall or a wall with a solid component, one with a mural nodule that's smaller than 5 millimeters, a main duct that's enlarged but not quite to that 10 millimeter mark, so 5 to 9 millimeters, or a duct with an abrupt change in caliber. There's some other things like growth. So if the cyst grows more than 5 millimeters over 2 years, if the patient has an elevated CA19-9, or they have a history of acute pancreatitis, because again, you're thinking about that being a harder mass that's obstructing the duct.
Thanks for going over that, Lexi. I always forget them and have to review them with a table next to me. So in this study, patients were generally followed postoperatively with an MRI abdomen with cholangiopancreatography 6 months after diagnosis, and then every 12 months thereafter in the absence of any concerns for progression. Pathologic evaluation determined presence of high-grade dysplasia or invasive carcinoma, and both of these were considered malignant for the sake of the study. A binary logistic regression model was used to estimate the effect size of the association between considered risk factors and the development of pathologic outcomes.
So the final study population consisted of 292 patients. Their median age was 64 at age of diagnosis, and their median surveillance time was 37 months. About 40% of them had worrisome features at diagnosis, and 5.5% had high-risk stigmata at diagnosis. And over the course of surveillance, 9.2% of these patients developed a worrisome feature after 5 years, and 16.7% developed a high-risk stigmata. 55% of these patients underwent a Whipple procedure, and 38% underwent distal pancreatectomy. 14% of patients had severe post-operative complications, and that included one patient death. At the final pathologic evaluation, 36% of the patients had high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer, and 5.5% of IPMN had a concomitant pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. Patients developed high-risk stigmata from a previous worrisome feature had significantly higher rates of final malignant pathology compared to those without worrisome features. and developing an additional worrisome feature or alternatively developing high-risk stigmata from an existing worrisome feature was independently associated with high-grade dysplasia on final pathology. Only obstructive jaundice was related to an increased incident of an invasive component. And then these results were then validated in another cohort of patients who underwent 36 months of surveillance instead of 12 with no other differences identified.
Okay, so those were the results of the study. The authors did note several limitations. Firstly, patients were only included if they had a pathologically confirmed branch duct IPMN. So this therefore excludes those with a presumed branch duct IPMN by radiographic or other criteria who are undergoing surveillance. And then additionally, given the retrospective nature of the study, certain details that are important, such as mural nodule size or CA19-9 levels, weren't always available for all of the patients. So now that we've discussed the article, we wanted to move into the second part of the episode, which will be our interview with Dr. Mark Agiani. Dr. Mark Agiani is a surgeon within the Department of General and Pancreatic Surgery at the University of Verona in Italy. His research interests include exocrine and cystic neoplasms of the pancreas, and he has authored over 100 scientific articles, to include the article we're discussing today. We're really excited to share this interview with you, and we hope you enjoy.
Well, guys, first of all, I would like to congratulate you for the podcast. I am really a big fan of it. Maybe you don't know, you have many supporters in Italy as well. I mean, it's great to have it on Spotify. Most of my residents actually love to hear, you know, your podcast. So big honor for me to be here.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So first question to get us started, could you tell us about how the study was first conceptualized?
So to tell you how this study was conceptualized, I have to bring you a little bit in Verona, where I work. So we are a pancreas center. So that means that we are fully devoted to the pancreas, and in particular to our cyst clinic. So it's specific for the study and, of course, the research on pancreatic cystic neoplasm, such as IPMN. So the story so far started when IPMN were firstly described, so back in the 80s. So of course, at the time, our knowledge about the biology of this entity was actually scarce. And what we had at the time then, you know, after all in the 90s and early 2000 was, data from surgical series. So the first knowledge was by operating on most, if not all, of this entity was that actually only a few of them were truly malignant entities, to the point that we then learned that they encompass a broad spectrum from completely benign to borderline entity, and just few of them are truly malignant entities. And their biology was actually very different from that of pancreatic cancer, pancreatic adenocarcinoma, that we all know has a very dismal prognosis. So at that time, we moved from very liberal surgical policies to observation, to active surveillance on most of the cysts. And we started to have then data, not just from surgical series, but also from observational study that provided us with more insights on their biology. And that's where we learned that most of these cysts can be safely surveilled over the time. And so this study came so from the knowledge from surgical series at the beginning, telling us, you know, that from the path reports, the actual pathological diagnosis, plus the data from the observational series, telling us, as I said, that most of these cysts will never progress into true malignancy. And so this is basically, you know, where it all started.
That's excellent. So this was kind of a meeting between those surgical studies and then the observational studies. This is kind of like a midpoint between those. Can Correct. You kind of describe your study design and how that thought process led to this design of this study?
So it basically came from, you know, reviewer number 3, okay? So who's basically the guy rejecting your paper, either because it's a surgical series So it has a selection bias. So, okay, then we said, let's move to observational series. But then in this way, we were lacking, you know, data from pathology. So basically the question of reviewer number three was, are we truly looking at an IPMN? So because I was a little bit, you know, sick of, you know, all this rejection, I'm kidding, of course, you know, I just wanted to combine the two things. So in this study, we, of course, needed a surgical series because we needed to have a final path diagnosis in terms of invasive cancer or high-grade dysplasia. But to be included in the series, we only searched for those who underwent, those patients who underwent observation before being selected for surgery. So in this way, we combined the data from observation to search for dynamic predictors of malignancy and then the data of our pathologists, because of course we were looking for predictors of either high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer. So we basically call this study the crossover study because it's focused on those who switched from observation to surgery. And in this way, we seek to define the value of these dynamic predictors by combining this data. Of course, it's a very selected cohort of individuals, but it's the only way to have both ways. So the knowledge from the observation plus the one from a surgical series.
Yeah, I think it really fills a gap in the knowledge that's been out there. I think you guys are really to be commended for doing it exactly that way, the crossover, as you described. One point I wanted to ask about is there have been previous studies where high-grade dysplasia and invasive cancer are kind of combined. And they say like there was a malignant result on final pathology. Can you talk about that choice? I thought you guys did a nice job of putting it together and separating it. So, you know, I really think when I take a cyst to the operating room, I'm hoping for high-grade dysplasia, right? If you operated before high-grade dysplasia, you operated too early. If you operated for cancer, you operated too late. High-grade dysplasia is really kind of the money when it comes to these IPMNs. So can you talk about the choice of whether those have to be lumped together or when you can and can't separate them?
Absolutely, Timothy. That's a great question. Honestly, when we refer to malignant cyst, there is kind of, you know, the tendency to put them together. But in fact, as you said, it makes a huge difference, you know, between these two entity, as we, of course, particularly on those individuals who are under active surveillance, seek for high-grade dysplasia. As you said, if you are observing a cyst and then it turns out that it has already developed an invasive cancer, you might have the feeling of, you know, being arrived too late, because at that point, you know, invasive cancer is already there. You can have positive lymph nodes, and you know that the prognosis then is actually way worse, and the risk of having recurrence, you know, of the IPMN becomes relevant. So in this way, we wanted to define these two different entities, even though we know that the biology is not truly the way we expect it to be. So we know that IPMN, like colon cancer, follow the adenoma to carcinoma sequence. But at the same time, we cannot really predict once we are observing a cyst, when this cyst goes through the steps of being evolved from low-grade dysplasia to high-grade dysplasia to invasive cancer. We know that it's like way more difficult, you know, to define that. So our goal, as you said, should be to find high-grade dysplasia, but still we're lacking reliable predictors for high-grade dysplasia. We're way better in defining predictors of invasive cancer, but as you said, this might be a little bit too late as the perfect goal for surgery, which should be, as you said, high-grade dysplasia.
Yeah, just on that note, the kind of figure you guys have with the green to red and all the different kind of pathways, I love that figure. I think that's like, if you were going to just remember one picture from the paper, I think that's so good. The kind of whether it came from nothing or progressed into worrisome, progressed into high risk. I mean, I think it really summarizes it well. I was kind of surprised that the patients with nothing, they still had a pretty significant rate of, you know, high-grade dysplasia and malignancy. I think that, you know, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but that's the tough part here is that we can't look a patient in the eye and say, like, you have no risk. And that's always the bugaboo for these. But but I really did like that figure. And I think for readers,
thank you.
Great figure to remember.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah,
that's,
we call it the traffic light.
I mean, that's what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to move from static predictors in the Fukuoka guidelines to dynamic predictors over the course of surveilling a patient, right?
Exactly. So we usually use this metaphor with our Italian patient, which is the picture versus movie thing. So when we first look at an MRI or a CT scan, it's like facing a picture. So of course, this is telling us the truth, but this is something static. It's just valid now, here. What's going to happen in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, we don't really know. So by adding picture after picture, we might be able to define what we call the movie of an IPMN. So also in terms of counseling, what we tell to our patient is, let's watch this movie together. We're not dealing with an adenocarcinoma, where it's actually a matter of like rushing because there is no time. You know, you have to define whether this patient needs chemo or upfront surgery. So with cysts, with most of them, I would say with the vast majority of them, we do have time to start watching this movie together. And if something changes, if there is no stability, which is, I would say, you know, one of the keywords in this story, then we might, you know, take different decisions like going for an endoscopic ultrasound or repeating another MRI at 3 months rather than 6 months. But again, we have time to watch this movie together. I think this is a take-home message that we would like to provide to our readers.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. I'm going to definitely steal that, the picture versus the movie. That's really good.
Thank you.
So on looking at your major findings of the study, can you review some of those for the listenership? What do you think were some of the major takeaways from the study?
Yeah, so I would say that the major takeaway, if I have to explain the study to my mom, who is actually very interested in what I do, but I have to, you know, let her understand what I'm talking about as she's not a doctor, is basically, I mean, we have to worry whenever something is changing, you know, in this movie that we were referring to. So stability is really something that is reassuring us, because one of the major findings is that it's not that bad, I would say, to have a worrisome feature on an IPMN, for example, which is stable over time, rather than having something which is going on, you know, observation after observation. So I would say that the major finding is that to harboring a stable feature is not as bad as having these features coming out control after control. So that's basically the take-home message of this traffic light. If you look at figure one, you know, the worst case scenario is when something which was stable becomes actually, you know, it comes out with some additional worrisome feature or even worse with high-risk stigmata. And then the relative risk of having either high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer, you know, is actually going up. And those are basically our surgical candidates. So the major take-home message is whenever you watch this movie, look for either stable features or for something that is developing, you know, control after control. So in this way, we're also able to define, I would say, a new knowledge on worrisome feature or high-risk stigmata that, according to the guidelines, are different, but probably they are, I would say, not all worrisome feature, I would say, are the same, but because we know that, for example, size has been questioned as a true worrisome feature. This paper adds also the knowledge of either static or dynamic worrisome features. So it's not truly important to harbor one or two or three features. It actually matters more to have it stable versus adding up worrisome features over time. And this is something that is really not clear in the current guidelines. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's a great summary that, you know, so just kind of talk us through. You see a patient for the first time and they have high-risk stigmata, your mindset there, and then worry some features. And can you talk through your algorithm of how closely you're going to surveil those two patients? Is it different? Is it the same? How many pictures do you want in that movie, so to speak, over the next 6 months to a year?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm not going to say that I would liberally follow up a patient with high-risk stigmata. So we really, you know, understand the value of finding a patient with, for example, jaundice, or whenever cytology comes back positive. I mean, we consider that as a major indication for surgery. So, of course, we don't have a cyst in front of us. We have a patient. So after assessing, whether a patient is not a surgical candidate, we consider that as a major indication for surgery. But, for example, let's focus on the dilation of the main pancreatic duct, for example, which is defined whenever it's above a centimeter as a high-risk stigmata. Are we really sure that we are watching at the main duct IPMN? Can we exclude at first observation that this is not chronic pancreatitis or just a dilation of the duct due to something else? So what am I going to say is that, once again, not all the features are the same. And once again, if we see a duct which is enlarging without any mass, then I would definitely put more attention into this case and consider this as a surgical candidate, rather than having a duct which is up to a centimeter, but it was the same 1 year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So then it also impacts on the counseling on our patient. So what is the feeling of this patient? Is he or she reluctant in having a surgery, or maybe proactive? Because also the psychological burden of harboring such a cyst is impacting on the quality of life. Mm-hmm. This is also, I think, very relevant when we deal with these individuals that we follow every year, every 6 months. So we got to know each other. And so it really matters also, you know, the way they follow our advice and also their fears, their expectations in surgery, also because we're facing pancreatic surgery. And I think this is really relevant.
Yeah. Just curious, what do you think about, I mean, I know the numbers were low, but the patients with no worrisome features, there was still 27% high-grade dysplasia in cancer. Do you share that number with your patient, or do you think that would just like cause a lot of worry that's unnecessary?
Exactly. No. I was very worried about this number. Still, it's a surgical series. So those numbers are biased because for some given reason, the surgeon decided to perform the surgery. So those are not the real number. This is not the risk. This is just, the ratio of those patients harboring malignancy. But for a given reason, the surgeon decided to go for surgery. So that's the reason why we had this number and we chose to publish the relative risk. So having a stable lesion is actually less worrying than having a lesion in progression. Yeah. So don't look at the raw data, but just at the relative risk.
One more factor I'm curious about is your counseling different for left versus right? You know, if we're talking about a distal versus a Whipple, how does that change your counseling, your decision points?
Well, when we scale the pros and cons of undergoing a surgery, we have to be very clear also in terms of risk of morbidity and mortality. So, I mean, of course, whenever a Whipple is there, well, first of all, we have to keep in mind that the planned surgery might change because we always want to assess the frozen section here. We're talking about IPMN, right? So we want to exclude that we have a positive margin in terms of high-grade dysplasia or even worse, invasive cancer. We also have now spyglass, pancreatoscopy. So the surgery itself can be very challenging. We're now shifting from being more aggressive. Well, back in the day, we used to perform way more total pancreatectomy for main duct IPMN. Now we try to define where the bulk of the IPMN is and try to do a partial resection and then analyzing, you know, what's left to see whether we have to actually extend our surgery or if we can be more conservative. But of course, for a patient, it makes a big difference to undergo a Whipple or a distal, as you were mentioning. But again, I mean, to say that a patient needs a distal pancreatectomy, still it's a pancreatectomy. So the risk of diabetes is relevant. We know that fistula after distal pancreatectomy can be as high as 30, 40%. And so this is, again, very relevant also by impacting the quality of life of the patient. So once again, we are very cautious, and also our policy towards resections for IPMN is to super select our candidates, definitely more than back in the day.
No, that's great. Thank you for explaining that. Looking forward, how would you, in your opinion, how do these findings play into future examination or revisions of the Fukuoka guidelines? Is this something that can be incorporated? And if so, how would that be done from a practical standpoint?
So that's, again, another great question, because, I mean, I love guidelines. So my disclosure is that I am part of the international guidelines on IPMN. I'm part of the panel. So, of course, I'm not here to blame the guidelines. We need the guidelines, actually, because, you know, as vaccination, they protect the population, and they also helps in, I would say, diminishing, you know, disparities between high volume centers and low volume centers. So we need guidelines. But of course, guidelines are not the Holy Bible. And for IPMN, they rely on a very low level of evidence, because that's what we have on IPMN. There is not a single randomized controlled trial so far on IPMN. Probably there will never be randomized controlled trial on some aspect of IPMN or pancreatocystic neoplasm. Truth is that most of the guidelines rely on surgical series. And surgical series, we know that they are biased, basically, by definition. So they basically rely on surgical series and expert opinion. So what is great, I think, about the current guidelines is that they provide you an easy way to triage your patient at first observation, okay? So if no features are present, you know you will never operate on this patient. You will surveil this patient. If you have a worrisome feature, better go for endoscopic ultrasound, possibly with FNA if there is a target. High-risk stigmata means basically a surgical candidate. So nice and easy. What happens then? It's actually less explored. So this paper highlights how far we are in defining what's the best treatment for our patient over time. So once again, what is the value of a dynamic evaluation? Guidelines do not tell us what to do dynamically, so meaning over time, because there is a lack of knowledge, of course. And then there is also another factor, which is, are we really sure that guidelines are followed in the clinical practice? Probably not because they're not known by clinician, but also because sometimes it's hard to follow the guidelines. I mean, some part of the algorithm of the international guidelines is actually even difficult to understand. And basically, it really relies a lot on endoscopic ultrasound, in repeating endoscopic ultrasound, which is very expensive and also very difficult from the patient, you know, to accept. So we even define an app, which is called iCyst. You can download it for free in either on the Apple Store or on Android. And it's also very cool because it provides you not just the international guidelines, but also the AGA guidelines on pancreatocystic neoplasm and the European guidelines. And sometimes it turns out that even guidelines themselves, they provide with different indications for the same cyst, for the same patient. So how difficult it is also for us to take decisions based on guidelines, if there is discrepancy even between the guidelines themselves. So honestly, the future will not rely on different guidelines, but on a single guideline. I am aware that next year there will be a new release of the international guidelines. And I really hope that studies like this and other observational series more focused on the biology of this entity will provide policies and new policies. Still, what we have is a patient in front of us and the guidelines that we have. So still it's very difficult to take decision and to share these decisions with our patient. honestly, it takes a lot of time. So to do a CS clinic, it's really time consuming, but I would say that it's the best time to be invested with our patients.
Speaking of challenges, this crossover study included 6 high volume centers. What challenges did you encounter in conducting the study?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely need multicentric study, right? To have, you know, the population of this study. I don't think there is a single center, you know, being able to accrue such numbers. I also think that the value of multicentric study is also minimizing the bias of having population either from Europe or the US. We also have studies from Asia, which I think add a lot of value. So it was difficult, first of all, you know, to have, you know, reliable data, because as I said, it's a surgical series, so biased by definition. And also when we had to define exactly what happened at different time points, it turned out that we had many, you know, a lot of missing data. So we had to be very selective only on those cases having data at each time point to define what happened, you know, time point after time point. So the ideal study would have been a prospective one where, you know, all data are taken rigorously. Of course, all the participating institution had prospectively maintained database, but of course, we know that still being a surgical series, you know, we had all the bias of a retrospective study.
Well, I think 2 questions. You hinted at some new guidelines. Can you give us a preview? Are the new guidelines, do you think they'll have anything about dynamic changes in the cyst? Do you think that's the, you know, the next logical step? Like you said, I think the current guidelines are great for the first time you meet the patient, but they don't speak a lot about the next step. So do you think that the international guidelines will get there? Were you pounding your fist at the last table or at the last meeting that should happen? Or
to my knowledge, because the discussion is still ongoing, because of course it's a huge work of reviewing all the literature, you know, for the update of the guideline. We won't have probably this new concept of either static or dynamic feature. Probably some of the worrisome feature will be downgraded. So like size, as I said, or also the concept of lymphadenopathy, which really doesn't make much sense. I think that not just this paper, but other paper are adding value to the knowledge that if something is changing, like growth rate, so rather than just size, rate will be enhanced as a factor triggering at least endoscopic ultrasound or second level diagnostic, if not surgery itself. But honestly, I think that most of the novelty will be regarding follow-up. So not just selecting the right patient for surgery, but also what to do with all those individuals that so far are just, you know, without end follow-up until surgically fit. That's what the guidelines are saying. And that's a huge, huge, huge topic, because it's of course not sustainable what we're doing right now. So what we're doing right now comes from a lack of knowledge, which is basically, well, follow-up all those cysts until the patient remains surgically fit. Doesn't make much sense, right? So there is no other pathology in the GI world that is followed up for just, you know, who knows how long. And it's also tough for the patient, you know, to accept that. And so I think this will be one of the major breakthroughs of defining targets, not just for surgery, but on the other side of the spectrum, who might be candidate for follow-up discontinuation. So honestly speaking, when I was in the US in 2013-14, the AGA guidelines came out with the world-known guidelines that were, I would say, very provocative, because, well, they were basically drafted by gastroenterologists telling us as surgeons, hey, it's not just about IPMN, okay? We also have other stuff, you know, to deal with. And for the first time, follow-up discontinuation was proposed. And this exploded as a bomb in our community, because we know that some IPMN will progress to cancer, not just after 5 years, but even after 10, 15 years. So of course, we don't want, you know, to risk to lose the chance for a cure for an IPMN eventually evolving into a cancer. Still, what we're doing right now is not sustainable. So there is indeed a subset of small IPMN, we call them trivial in Verona, that will never progress into cancer, or at least that do not harbor a risk higher than the age-matched general population. I think that this is, I would say, the way we should look at things. So risk zero does not exist. It will never exist in life, probably, not just in the world of IPMN or in medicine. So yes. Just because we all have a pancreas, of course, the risk will never be zero. So whenever we're able to catch a subset of cysts not harboring a risk higher than the general population of the same sex, the same year, then we probably find those individuals who might be candidate for follow-up discontinuation safely, of course, after a certain time in which we assess whether the CC is stable or not. So once again, the stability, the concept of stability remains key. But I think that this will be the major advancement in the new guidelines because, as I said, for healthcare system, this is putting really too much pressure right now in terms of cost, but also in terms of psychological burden for all those individuals who've been follow-up for now for years for their cyst.
Can you give us your criteria for the patients that have that you stop watching?
Yeah, I mean, we still don't have this level of evidence to recommend follow-up discontinuation. So I would say that to date, the only true candidate for either, you know, patients above the age of 80 or those that, you know, because of comorbidities will never make it, you know, to a pancreatic resection. Okay. Still, I can anticipate you that those cysts not developing any worrisome feature nor high-risk stigmata for at least 5 years of observation. So we keep 5 years also because, you know, it has been mentioned by the AJA guidelines and it's easy to remember, all in follow-up. But if those individuals do not experience any progression of the cyst and they are now, after 5 years, above the threshold of 75, we now are, you know, starting to stop surveillance. Okay. And this will be a great goal because we already made a calculation that this would save billions in terms of CT scan and MRI for our healthcare system, because we know that the risk of pancreatic cancer is age related. So the risk itself for a 75 years old individual is actually high, I would say relatively high, and it's not dependent on the cyst, but because of the age of the patient. So this is basically our philosophical view on the potential follow-up discontinuation, even though we all know that in the future, biomarkers, reliable biomarkers should drive our decision. But, you know, it's always, you know, the last slide of the presentation. In the future, you know, seeking for reliable biomarkers. I also want to have answers now for my clinic tomorrow. And what we have tomorrow is a patient in front of me, an MRI, a CT scan, and we need to take, you know, our decision based on that. And so I think that's the best that we can do right now.
Yeah, I don't know that we have time to go into biomarkers, but I would be very curious about that as well, your thoughts. But I guess the other question I had was, what's kind of the next big project coming out of the Verona Clinic? What paper should we keep an eye out for? What do you guys kind of, what's at the front of your mind as far as what you're looking at in your data now?
Well, my choice would be on this concept of trivial IPMN. Okay. So I mean the now the most of our energies are into defining this target for follow-up discontinuation. Again, it will be a multicentric effort, and hopefully it will be, you know, out soon. Again, we feel the urge now to identify a target for follow-up discontinuation, but also we have many translational projects, you know, again, seeking for novel new biomarkers in the blood, in the cyst fluid. But the problem is with this biomarker they have to be both reliable and all, but also cheap to be used in the clinical practice. So that's a major issue. There are several publications out there, great results, biosignature, but still, the reason why those techniques are not incorporated in the clinical practice to date is because they are either very expensive or not validated on external cohort. So that's a major issue right now. So once again, so far from the clinical standpoint, our efforts are now in defining not just the true surgical candidates based on the biology of the disease, which is the most important factor, but also who are the potential candidates for continuation.
And what, just kind of a philosophical question, what kind of follow-up, like if you want to look at 300 patients, what's your follow-up cutoff point going to be where you say, okay, we have enough patients to really answer this question? Do you need 10 years, 15 years? You have 5-year data, I'm sure, but do you have 15-year data on 300 patients? You know what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though it's impossible to have sort of a power calculation.
Yeah.
I mean, I would roughly say that once the median follow-up is longer than 5 years, then we can start having some answers. Also because, some great papers out there, they just have just a short follow-up. And while we know that the biology of this disease is very long, so without a medium follow-up of at least 5 years, we are absolutely blind. Our Kaplan-Meier will never, be able to answer to these questions. We have to tackle not just the evolution of a cyst into an invasive IPMN. We also have the entity called concomitant pancreatic cancer, which again mix up our data, because we know that the risk is not just the one depending on the cyst itself, but it's also the risk of harboring a cancer far away from the IPMN. And probably one of the factors that puts a lot of fog in our data is the fact that in some cases we have an actual pancreatic cancer which develops far away from the cyst. But indeed, in the database, it comes out to have a malignancy. Again, only the biology will unravel the question. It's really intriguing as a research field, I would say.
So to round things out, what do you think is the major takeaway message for, say, the general surgery trainees?
So first of all, take your time. Take your time, because here, and this has to be clearly said to the patient, we are not facing an actual pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. Here, we are dealing with pancreatic cystic neoplasm. So keep in mind, the vast majority of them will never require surgery. Take your time to study the situation, get your scans. If you have any doubt, if you have features like the war zone features, well, ask your endoscopist, who's your best friend, to do an endoscopic ultrasound, and then take your time to watch the movie with your patient. What do I mean with that? I mean that by adding MRI after MRI, CT scan after CT scan, you can safely watch this movie with your patient and be ready to change your decision. Or share with your patient what you know, but also what you don't know, because indeed you don't know what's going to happen in 1 year, 2 years, or 5 years, but get your popcorn in a metaphoric way and watch this movie with your patient, because there is no hurry. Only a minority of these cysts will require surgery. And so this is, I would say, the philosophical concept of the study, but also of the management of IPMN.
All right. So with that, that concludes our episode today and our interview with Dr. Marchegiani. A huge thank you again to Dr. Marchegiani for his time, his expertise, and flexibility as we navigated multiple time zones to schedule this interview. Thank you to the BTK audience for sticking with us throughout our deep dive into IPMNs over the last two episodes. It can be a confusing topic, but hopefully we've broken it down for everyone while also sharing the varied shades of gray in management of these patients, as well as the groundbreaking research that's currently being done on the topic. We hope you enjoyed the episode and learned a lot, and have a great day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.